Wild card, baby. Three of the four wild card series have completed it, and we are going to recap them right here on this episode of Baseball Barbacast alongside the Mets and the Brewers, who refuse to make it easy. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world who knows that the reason that the Braves, the Orioles, and the Astros all lost today is because they had members of the tribe playing on Rosh Hashanah. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman, Max Fried, Alex Bregman, Dean Kremer, and the Mets all lost today. What's juicier than that, baby?
Hey, more time for apples and honey for them tomorrow as three team seasons have come to a close on the opening evening of the Jewish New Year. Yes, we will be recapping three wildcard series, which have completed. We will save our division series preview for tomorrow night. We are recording this very, very, very late on Wednesday evening after the Padres finished dispatching of the Atlanta Braves and after a day in which the Baltimore Orioles rolled over and the Houston Astros are not going to the American League Championship Series. Maybe that should be the headline. We have a lot to get to, Jake, and it is very late. So where would you like to begin? We're first of all, this is just a great time of year. I'm having a good time. Are you having a good time?
It's the best, man. It's the best.
Not complicated. These games are great. Four postseason games, one day is wonderful. Now, let's before we get into the games, we're going to start with the American League Series, and then we'll do Padres Braves, and then we'll get to Mets Brewers. Again, if you're listening to this on Thursday and you're antsy for this game three, we're going to get to Mets Brewers at the very end. So we're going to recap first, and we'll get to Mets Brewers at the end. So if you're focused on the Mets, you can skip ahead. But let's talk about the Orioles, Jake. Should we do Orioles first? Because that's where you were. Or how do you want to start this?
Sure, let's do the Orioles first. Okay. I thought you would never ask. In fact, I wanted you to never ask.
I'm saying that you have to talk about it because it's part of your job. But we're going to do that because you were there, certainly for game one. And let's start with the on-the-ground reporting because I was writing off of Tigers, Astros, but I was not in the building. So let's go to the man who was in the stands for all of game one and for some of game two as we pivot back to Rosh Hashanah in a second. But let's do game one first.
Yeah.
Tell me what it was like. I know you wrote your game story about how it was drizzling. It was raining. It was like, oh, are we going to get delayed? And then no, we're going to play this game. And but apparently the Orioles did not quite get the memo. Like, we're playing now. The game started.
Baltimore's offense acted like the first pitch had gotten moved back because they did not score a run. Actually, the entire game, Corbin Burnes, their ace, was utterly dominant, working into the ninth inning, becoming the first pitcher in the playoffs to throw a pitch in the ninth inning for starter since...
I read
Steven
your story.
Strasburg.
That's a great nugget. It's a great
Steven
nugget.
Strasburg World Series Game 6, 2019. And the first pitcher to throw a pitch in the ninth inning of a game that his team lost for a starter since Matt Harvey World Series Game 5 against the Royals in 2015, something that Mets fans have tried to push down. So Corbin Burnes did everything that he could do. He fulfilled his end of the bargain. The Orioles paid handsomely to acquire him over the winter, and he delivered. The offense, however, did not. They had opportunities. They had a runner on second base with nobody out. I believe in the third inning, James McCann struck out. They had first and third, I believe in the fifth inning with one out. And James McCann, he struck out again. Why was James McCann playing in a playoff game? Well, Adley Rutschman DH'd, as he does often against lefties. Should the franchise catcher be catching all the time? Probably. But who am I to say? And the Orioles just could not get a run across. And you had this feeling, and this is something that happens in college baseball a lot, where as the team struggles and struggles over the course of an elimination game or a big playoff game, and you just feel this tension kind of creeping in like a Demogorgon from the Upside Down. It's just this like dark cloud getting closer and closer. And all the fans just are like, oh my God, we're never going to score. We're never going to score. And they didn't. And they didn't score. The only run of the ball game, a Bobby Witt Jr. single through the left side. The Orioles opting not to pitch to him with a runner on third and two outs. I think that's actually a totally reasonable decision. Corbin Burns is rolling. If you're Corbin Burns, you want to go get the guy. Bobby Witt Jr. is really good and he beat you. Whatever. So that was
not to pitch around him. Yeah. Opting to pitch to him, right? With the base open. Yeah. Sorry. That's, I mean, and again, we'll spin it back to Bobby Witt here in game two. But that feeling that you were describing of it's impossible to score, that is a painful feeling. But sometimes that happens in games where you are down by multiple runs and it's like, it's impossible. They're up by three or four. Like, there's no way that this team's scoring four or five, right? But that's what made this all the more painful, because it's not like Kansas City was bursting out ahead and you were looking at this giant gap. You just had this feeling of they just need that one swing, and it didn't come. It did come in game two momentarily.
Feeling is like a finger trap or a sword stuck in a rock, where the harder you pull, the less likely it is you will remove the sword from the rock.
It's more stuff.
But if you relax and you pull, it will come
out. Didn't happen.
Did happen in game two. Yes. Hey, I will say the only Oriole who looked locked in the entire time was Cedric Mullins.
Yes. Anything else in game one?
I should say Cole Reagans was sensational.
Yes, please.
I have not mentioned that, and I sincerely apologize to Royals fans. Clearly, I'm someone who's looking at this through a Baltimoreic lens.
That's fine.
Reagans was outstanding. His difference maker was the heater inside to right-handed hitters. Reagans is a lefty. He had great command of that pitch. The changeup was amazing, and the O's just had no response. That's what sunk Baltimore last year, an inability to face left-handed pitching in the playoffs. Same problem again against Reagans. Then the bullpen held it down, and Lucas Ersig coming in the eighth inning, closing it out. Phenomenal.
Real deal.
What a story he is.
Yep.
High pick as a position player, had a lot of issues off the field, got his life under control, came back as a pitcher with the Milwaukee Brewers, and then the Oakland A's, throwing 99. A's traded him to the Royals, and he has BCE, big closer energy.
Yeah, I mean, and we saw it in both games, but he has some truly outrageous stuff, and it's been a game changer. I mean, that is, it's textbook, you know, deadline acquisition, and I mean, that's why you get him, you know. And spinning it back to Baltimore, as you wrote, like, that's why you get Corbin Burns, and he did his thing. And there were moments during the season where you started to wonder if you were getting the best version of Corbin Burns. But boy, had he turned it on lately, and here it was, and he did the thing, and they still lost.
Whenever an ace shoves in October and you lose, it feels like a big missed opportunity, because every playoff game is a gift. But when Corbin Burns, who the Orioles paid handsomely for as a rental, makes his only postseason start for you, he's probably leaving in free agency, it's an even bigger missed opportunity, because now he's just like not on your team anymore. And Joey Ortiz, who they traded to Milwaukee, is going to be the everyday shortstop for the next 5 years. Right. Mm-hmm. And so that is an added level of pain. Game two, the Royals, they score in the first inning, double from Michael Massey leading off the game. And he eventually comes around to score on a RBI single from Vinny Pasquantino, who we should now introduce as a crucial character in the story. Vinny, who is indeed a friend of the program, fractured his thumb about a month ago and had not appeared in a game before game one. He was put on the roster. The Pasquatch rises. He went hitless in the first game, but in game two, he delivers an RBI single through the right side for his first hit since coming back. And like, just seeing Vinny getting to play postseason baseball was really cool. You and I talk about this a lot, like off the air. You know, we are obviously reporters now and we cover the game for a living, but there are certain players who we would consider our friends in a way, and whose success and happiness I think gives us joy. And Vinny is certainly in that category. And for someone who, you know, waddled through some dark days with the Kansas City Royals, him being on that stage was very, very cool.
Yeah, not to mention, of course, the context of his injuries. So, and that's as we saw in these two games, like, you know, they didn't need him to hit five home runs. They needed him to give them a couple big hits or one big hit, you know, early on as he gives them the lead. And now this was an earlier lead than they had gotten in game one. And now the Orioles, even down by one, it's that same feeling. And Seth Lugo, who's also had an incredible, you know, season, is pitching maybe not quite as overwhelmingly dominant as Reagan's, but is still getting a lot of outs very quickly. But now I want to turn it back over to you because you were there and then you weren't, which is understandable.
Yeah, so I needed to leave a little early because it is Rosh Hashanah tonight. My family does a big dinner on the night before. So I packed up my stuff. And in the fourth inning, I got in my car and I drove to DC to be with my family. I had the game on the radio, was following along. And then the Orioles broke through. Cedric Mullins, who was the one guy cool, calm, composed, and under control, goes yard in the fifth and Camden Yards explodes because it is like the first time that they have gotten to celebrate practically anything the entire series through, I think it was 13 scoreless innings. So he homers and it's like, now we go.
Yep.
Orioles load the bases with no outs after Mullins. And it's like, Royals are on the ropes, gotta score at least one, probably two. And that does not happen. Anthony Santander, as Orioles announcer Kevin Brown said on the broadcast, tried to hit one off his face on the scoreboard and popped up in the infield. Colton Cowser then swung at a pitch that would have hit him in the back and did hit him in the hand and struck out. Like, he swung and missed. It hit him.
Fractured his hand.
He was injured.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, fractured hand.
Really?
Yeah, reported that after the game. So, I mean, obviously, hopefully not something that's impacting him next season. But, I mean, yeah, it was a freak. Again, this is Angel Zerpa, the Zerp dog. Nasty Zerp. Lefty coming in to face Cowser. So tough
it's
matchup.
Actually, by the way, it's Zerpa.
Zerpa, sorry.
Zerpa.
But he just throws this kind of tailing fastball inside that Cowser, I guess, for some reason, thinks he can get to. And it was
No. Cowser was like, if I get a fastball, I'm swinging. Okay. That's what he said in his mind. And it's like hard left on left.
Sure. Yeah.
And it swung and it hit him. Strike.
Yeah.
Three, out two. Adley Rutschman comes up to the plate. Serpa, who just would have hit Cowser to score a run, throws two straight balls. And this is the moment I wrote my whole story around. This is the moment that perfectly encapsulates the Orioles season and the passivity that kind of came over them in this October for the second straight year. The 2-0 count. I know he's throwing. I'm listening on the radio and I know a meatball's coming, right? Everyone in the yard knows it's coming and he gets it. 98 through the geographic center. Okay. This was like freaking Topeka, Kansas, down the middle.
You couldn't throw it more down.
You can't throw it more down the middle. It was crazy how down the middle it was.
You can't. And it was 98. But it was
like,
down the middle.
It was right down the middle.
And you knew the plan was to throw it down the middle because it was 2-0. The command was gone. And it was like, all he wants to do right now is throw it down the middle. And he did.
And Adley blinked. And it wasn't just that he took the pitch, Jordan. It was how he took the pitch.
Yeah.
When you watch the video back, the second he decides not to swing, you just see like a ghost of regret tackle him. And he's like standing in the box for an abnormal amount of time, like looking around and kind of jittering and like realizing what the moment was. Overwhelmed him in that place, in that time. Does not make Adley a bad player or a bad person. But in this particular moment, the lights were a little bit too bright. He ends up getting out, grounding out to end the inning. Royals score in the next half to take the lead on a Bobby Witt infield single. And one thing that you hear about Bobby Witt when you talk to Royals people is that he does something special every day, that his game is so multifaceted that he can impact it in so many ways. And I know that sounds really cliche, but we see the example of that in this series. He does not really square up a baseball in either of these games. His RBI single in game one was hit, not, I think it was like 83, right? He did not have any extra base hits, but he was superb on defense, making some incredible throws like from the grass, and his speed, his wheels were a difference maker. He hits one up the middle with two outs and a runner on third. Jordan Westbrook diving play, tries to throw to first, and Witt just beats it out because, oh, what do you know? He's also, what, the fastest player in the league.
Yeah, and that is, as we see in these games where the margins are very small and one run might be enough, that's everything. It's that is part of his superpower. And sure, it comes, and it's also an interesting one because Bobby Witt Jr. is not yet a great base stealer. I know that sounds weird, but like efficiency wise, he hasn't quite mastered the art of the stolen base yet. 72% success rate for the fastest player in baseball is not very good. It's well below league average. He gets caught a lot. But that doesn't mean the speed can't impact in other ways. And when you have a ground ball like this, it is a tough play for Westberg, but it was still close enough. You know, Westberg, this is an amazing play from Westberg that most hitters are, most runners are out, but not Bobby Witt Jr. And the Royals took the lead. And then that same feeling ended up kind of sinking back in for Baltimore over the remaining innings.
And that was so disappointing. Again, Royals fans, you won the series. I acknowledge that. And I, but again, like this is how I'm,
yeah,
this is my perspective. Mullins like lifts the Orioles out of the lurch. He wakes everyone up. He rouses Baltimore from the slumber. And Santander, Cowser, and Rushman, your 3, 4, 5 hitters are up with zero out, the bases loaded. They put everyone right back to sleep.
Yeah.
Right. And then from there, the O's don't get a runner in scoring position again. And it's the game. Royal mm-hmm. score, that's the game. Right. Ursig, unbelievable again in the ninth inning.
Yep.
But this series went, I know I picked the Orioles, but I guess I previewed the series by saying, I don't think the Royals can hit, and I expect the Orioles to.
Mm-hmm. I picked the Orioals too. I thought 50% they'd heat up. I was right. Even more wrong.
The Royals did not hit in this series. Not really at all. The one thing I think I underrated was the bullpen. They executed their pitches. Yeah. Like the Orioles helped them, and I think they let the moment get to them, the Orioles, a little bit. But like Kansas City's arms did not make too many mistakes throughout.
No. And that's a huge reason why they're here, right? It is the pitching that has gotten them here, despite baseball's worst offense in September, that might still be struggling, and going to be a little bit harder to get away with that against the Yankees. But that is a conversation for another day. Any final Orioles thoughts before we move on to Astros Tigers?
10 straight postseason losses now, dating back to the 2014 ALCS. Something has to be different now. You can look overwhelmed by the lights in an October with a young roster and say, we will learn from this, we will change, we will adapt and try again. And the Orioles did that. And I think that's reasonable. However, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. I think it maybe has a little bit to do with the way that they teach hitting. Where I think a lot of teams are teaching, like, maybe I'm overgeneralizing a bit. The Orioles like to teach hitting of almost pitch selection and to the point, but not there quite as of passiveness, where it's like, don't swing, don't swing, don't swing, swing, right? And it's easier to teach back from that. And that's why Gunnar Henderson and Adley and these guys are good in a lot of ways, is because they hit the right pitches when they're going well. But when you get into especially over larger samples. And I think that is a strategy that works, clearly. I mean, they've developed a lot of really good hitters in a really short amount of time. But now we have a situation where, for whatever reason, it hasn't worked in 2 straight Octobers, and they got to mix up the equation here a little bit, because you can't just keep running it back with the exact same group. Again, the core is really young. The core is really good. I don't think they will let go of Skipper Brandon Hyde. I think also totally reasonable, right? Mm-hmm. But the expectations are higher now for the Orioles.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is no longer a fun story. The glean of being promising is no more.
Definitely.
The window is open firmly, and it is time for them to do it. And I am very curious to see how they spend in free agency this offseason with the new ownership group at the helm.
So that is the Orioles. Good luck to the birds this winter. Orioles, and, again, dude, we will talk about you a lot more in the coming days.
I was impressed with a lot of things with the Royals, particularly on pitching and defense. Melendez made a great play. Oh, sorry. One last thing I should mention. I don't want this to sound salty, but like Jordan Westberg in game one, ball to left field to the big wall. That's out in 28 stadiums. Ramon Arias today, ball that's out in 27. And like, no sympathy. It's the Orioles' own dumb fault for building a stupid, big, tall wall.
If anything, it's just funny. It's
hilarious.
It's a very, very goofy turn of events when that wall is not helping you when you need it the most.
It was built for Asher Wojciechowski, and he's not here anymore.
No, he's not. All right. So the Royals move on. Let's send it to Houston. This was something to behold. The Detroit Tigers and A.J. Hinch going down to Minute Maid Park and seeing if this magical end of the season can continue against an Astros team that had course corrected after a catastrophic April. They won the division, but they didn't get that first round bye. They didn't get that week off where they could reset, get healthy, which is very important for them, especially with Yordan hobbled. And they had to face Tarek Skubal immediately. And while everything else on paper would suggest that this was something of a lopsided matchup, even recognizing the Tigers' bullpen numbers, everything said Houston. They had 500 more games of postseason experience, and it's the Astros in October. All right, as we said during our preview, are they really going to lose in the first round? Really? Well, the Tigers had Tarek Skubal in game one, and ultimately, that was just not enough, but it basically just put them on even ground to the point where Skubal was amazing and Framber Valdez was not. And when the Tigers took, you know, with three straight singles up the middle and they put together three runs, that is three runs that even with the Astros lineup, with Tarek Skubal on the mound, with him throwing the way he was throwing, that was a very, very, very large lead. And so, I mean, at that point, it was like, all right, well, let's see if Skubal can throw 110 or 15 pitches and get this at least through eight. But he's only able to go six as he seems to be dealing with some sort of cramping at the very end of his outing. And so they have to turn it over to the bullpen, but that isn't necessarily a bad thing for the Tigers, as here comes the anonymous army of incredible relievers. First,
we have the interchangeable Caucasians who I all mean, throw 96.
Oh my gosh. Will Vest, who, I mean, this guy was a Rule 5 pick by the Mariners. He made his debut with the Mariners. The Tigers did not protect him. They're like, yeah, you can have Will Vest for a season. Oh, eventually, the Mariners returned him because they're like, ah, whatever. A couple years later, Will Vest, with the outing of his life, just, I mean, throwing harder than ever, just nasty changeups. He was incredible. He gets four strikeouts of his five outs. Tyler Holton comes in, gets to Kyle Tucker. And then we get to Jason Foley in the ninth. And it's like, all right, what you got, Astros? You really going to go out sad like this? You're not going to do something? And they made it interesting. They made it interesting, but not quite interesting enough. As the bat, or I should say, as the game lands on Jason Hayward, of all people.
And by this point, they take Foley out. In comes Bo Brisky. Mm-hmm. And to face Jason Hayward, who started this year on the Houston, on the Los Angeles Dodgers, ended up on the Astros after struggling quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this inning begins with Yordan, who can barely move.
Can't walk.
Like, truly.
Can't move.
Could not move. Rocket to left field for a leadoff double, his second hit of the game. Bregman single, Yiner Diaz single, makes it 3-1. And then we get this bunt. Pena bunts the runners to second and third. Amazing play by Jake Rogers to get this first out. But then here comes Brisky. Caratini lines out. Chaz McCormick walks. Brisky's throwing as hard as he had in his entire life. He's touching 100. We've never seen this from Bo Brisky. Bobrisky. And then Jason Hayward puts together a pretty decent at bat and rips one. And rips one in a way that for a split second, you're like, that's down the line. The Astros just tied or won the game. Like, that is what it looked like.
And the sound tells you first. You don't actually see Spencer Torkelson catch the line drive because it was faster than the camera. But you hear the crowd go, ah, oh.
And that can only mean one thing. Game over.
See you.
Incredible escape. But Tarek Skubal did the thing. Again, postseason debut, right? Everyone's like, all right, Cy Young, let's see you do it against the Astros. He's like, yeah, that's fine. No problem. It's not that I hadn't watched Tarek Skubal this year, because I had. But really watching obviously every pitch was like, holy crap. So he is very, very, very special. But then immediately you're like, who's pitching tomorrow? Because that was always going to be a question for the Tigers.
And it doesn't matter. As AJ Hinch said in his pregame press conference, our pitching strategy is Tarek Skubal and pitching chaos.
For the Astros, it was going to be Hunter Brown. And we learned shortly before the game that it was going to be Tyler Holton, or I guess shortly at the end of game when Tyler Holton, who pitched in that first game, just a one batter, Tyler Holton opening versus Hunter Brown. Hunter Brown, by the way, making his first career postseason start. He had appeared in the playoffs a few times over the past few years for Houston, but now the depth chart finally had cleared out and he had become this breakout righty and just an unbelievable, you know, last few months of the season.
Hunter Brown, who grew up in Detroit as a Tigers fan, was he a mole? Was this a long con for him to throw this game?
Sure,
was
sure
he
going to
allow a bunch of ding-dongs and then rip his Astros shirt off and there would be a Magliore Donia's jersey underneath?
And all of his friends at Wayne State would be just be going crazy?
Yeah!
No. Hunter Brown was doing the opposite. Hunter Brown, you would not know Hunter Brown was ever a Tigers fan the way he was pitching in this game, because he was outstanding. He, for five innings, he was completely overwhelming. He has two incredible breaking balls. And I've made this comp before. It's Glasnow-esque, right? He's not throwing that many changeups. He's got a little bit more of that than Glasnow, but the overwhelming heater, and of course now he's got two different fastballs with two different breaking balls, is really what makes him really special. So he's just dominant. And for five innings, it's him versus four Tigers pitchers, right? We get Holton to Hanafee to Herder to Brisky. Okay. Again,
sure.
Tigers pitching chaos. That's the plan. But then top of the sixth, Parker Meadows leads off the innings. Hunter Brown's still in, and I don't know if it was the first pitch. I think it was the second pitch. Pulls one down the right field line. And AJ Hinch finally heard a bounce off the right field foul pole that he could enjoy.
Bang!
Bang! Parker Meadows gives the Tigers the lead. Of course, you know what I'm referencing. The last game AJ Hinch ever managed for the Astros, the 2019 World Series.
Howie Kendrick
went gong off the right field foul pole. This was not quite as high stakes, but Parker Meadows gives them the lead. And now it's like, now it's countdown time, right? It's like, okay, awesome. Who's going to get these outs? But because they'd already used Holton and they'd already used, you know, Brisky, I guess, we're like, all right, who's going to finish this game? And so then you realize that Jackson Jobe is warming up.
And Jackson Jobe, who is 22 years old and looks 20 years younger than that, has made just two appearances in the major leagues.
Yes.
His third career appearance in relief in Houston in a one-run game against the Astros.
Yes.
And you're like, wow, hey, really trust this kid. And guess what? It didn't really work.
Yeah. And this is the moment that I zoomed in on here that I wrote about, because like again, like his two appearances were up by six runs in his debut against Tampa and the White Sox. So this was a little bit different. Now, it was the bottom of the lineup, and Hinch talked about after the game, like, yeah, I put him in a tough spot. We were just hoping to get it, to turn the lineup over so that we could go to Sean Gunther to Kyle Tucker. But okay, whatever. It's still a one-run game in this situation with a chance to advance, like all these things. He's pitched in two major league games. Jackson Jobe was not bad, but things unraveled very quickly. He hits Caratini. We get a single after that, and then a bunt, a perfect bunt from Dubon. Just beautiful. And now it's just like you blink and the space is loaded and nobody's out. And here comes John Singleton. And at this point, it's like, well, like no one's ready. Like once they go to Singleton, maybe you could have panicked and brought in Gunther there. But no, it's like, okay, Jackson, like do your best, buddy. And Singleton lines one to Spencer Torkelson, who makes a diving play, tries to throw home to get the force, and Jake Rogers just drops it. I mean, it was a
tough throw.
It was a tough throw, but like Jake Rogers, an unbelievable defender, like you would expect him to make that play. And instead, the game's tied. Next batter is Jose Altuve. And now, again, now it's bases loaded and it's Jose Altuve and there's nobody out. And Jackson Jobe's still on the mound. And you're just like, like, how did we get here? Like, what is going on? Is this how it's going to fall apart? But, you know, he lost one to right field and Vierling comes in and Pena, just an unbelievably aggressive send here to try to score on the sac fly. And he does. He gets in safely. Astros take the lead 2-1. And then you're like, all right, well, that... And again, it felt like it could have gone a lot worse because of the situation that it had just been, but it was still kind of like, damn, like, did we just give the Astros life? And now here comes Ryan Pressly and Josh Hader, which on paper is like exactly what you want. Ryan Pressly, 20 consecutive postseason appearances without allowing an earned run. However, Ryan Pressly in the regular season this year has been good, but he's not the same guy anymore. He's just not. And the Tigers were just unfazed and very quickly respond. They end up loading the bases. And I mean, here comes Hader to try and, you know, stop the bleeding. This is why you pay him the big bucks. This is why you pay the closer, right? So that you can bring him in this situation. And instead, he walks Spencer Torkelson on 4 pitches. And then Andy Ibañez pinch hits. One of the, you know, the buttons that Hinch can press on the offensive side is Andy Ibañez to pinch hit against a lefty. He does it and he delivers. Lines the ball down the left field line, bases clearing double. Tigers up by 3. And just in a blink, it was like everything, the disaster Jobe inning, you had forgotten it ever happened. And the Astros at that point just rolled over and they didn't get on base again. And Will Vest closes it out and the Tigers are moving on. It was an incredible, incredible sequence.
That image of Hader, where he's walking back to the mound after allowing the double, and 3 Tigers are in the background, their arms around each other, jumping up and down like children who just... I have no analogy because I'm tired.
It's because it's after midnight. It was amazing. Yeah.
It was amazing. It was truly an amazing thing. And so Houston's ALCS streak is over. 7 consecutive years, and look,
Houston's ALDS streak is over.
That's funny. I want to say this. Yeah. The Astros are many things.
Yes.
They have been a great villain for our game. They have. At times deserved, at times undeserved. I personally think the Jose Altuve hate has made us forget how unbelievable of a player he is. And I think that the Astros organization deserves a lot of credit for getting to 7 straight American League Championship Series in a row. That's crazy. I don't care how many cans they were banging on or weren't banging on. That's unbelievable. That is unbelievable. And now that we're at the end of it, of that streak, not that they're going to stink moving forward, but we reached the end of an era. This is the end of an era, right? Yeah. I canceled hotel reservations in Houston today.
I promise you a lot of baseball writers had hotel reservations in Houston because that's just what you do this time of year. You book hotels in Houston.
I made those in February. No,
but no, listen, the fact they were even here is incredible. This team was 7-19. They proved a lot this year.
12-24.
A lot happened that while maybe Alex Bregman leaves, they certainly have
Justin Verlander.
Justin Verlander, sure. A very strange end to the Verlander tenure, potentially. But man, I mean, there's a lot of really good baseball players on this team. I mean, and a lot of pitchers that are very good that could be coming back next season, right? They're not going anywhere. But I do think it is fair to describe this as the end of an era because it might be the end of Bregman, because it is the end of this ALCS streak. And then the last thing about them, just in terms of this particular season, is Yusei Kikuchi doesn't throw a pitch. Their aggressive move to trade 3 very good prospects who immediately helped Toronto and might help them next year for Yusei Kikuchi immediately looked brilliant when they won his first nine starts and he looked awesome. And then he didn't even get to pitch.
And to be clear, that is not why they lost.
No, no.
Like, the offense was bad.
Yeah. The Tigers' pitching was great. Same thing with Orioles Kansas City. But the fact that they didn't get themselves to the whole point of trading for Kikuchi is pretty astonishing. That is a pretty amazing thing. So
it almost didn't look real, dude. Like, it really didn't look real. And you could see that on the Tigers' faces.
But also, six straight postseason loss at home. Lost all four games against Texas in the CS last year and against Minnesota. And then now these two. So that's weird. So that could be something we bring up when they're in the playoffs next year. But anyway, Tigers, I will see you in Cleveland. I'm not going to say anything else because I am so excited. I will be at the game on Saturday. I'll be at the games in Detroit next week. So again, plenty more Tigers coverage to come.
This podcast has the ALCS covered as I will be at Yankees game one and two.
Yes. So
unfortunately, I will not be making the trip to Kansas City. but boy, oh boy, do I wish I was. Let's take a quick break. When we return, we will move over to the Nationals. And welcome back to Baseball Barbercast. Jake Mintz, Jordan Schusterman. We're going to skip ahead to the late game here because the Padres are moving on and the Braves are going home. And that's a little bit different than the Brewers and the Mets, who are going to play another baseball game. So let's talk about Padres, Braves, the Braves, who, after winning game 162 against the Syracuse Mets, that's too harsh.
I mean, against the is it Binghamton though? I mean, where was Joey Lucchese all year?
In Syracuse. After winning game 162 against a man who owns an apartment in Syracuse, New York. That's okay. Also not nice.
After winning past 162. Game 162. The Braves beat the Mets. They were not really trying. And what did they get for that?
They got to play
the next day on the other side of the country. Which proved to be a lot harder than playing halfway across the country. As we'll get to the Mets and Brewers a little bit later.
I would like to say something. Oh, and just very quickly. Chris Sale, not on the playoff roster. No. Huge deal for game one because the Braves had to start A.J. Smith-Shawver, who started twice for them.
Here's a good way to put... reference how ridiculous it is that AJ Smith-Shawver had to start this game. Younger than Jackson Jobe.
AJ Smith-Shawver one game.
Still one 21 game. And younger than Jackson Jobe. And he had to start this game, let alone come in and get some outs.
AJ Smith-Shawver, who is a sophomore on the same high school baseball team as Bobby Witt Jr. when Bobby was a senior. Mm-hmm. AJ came in to a tough spot because Chris Sale was not there. I'd like to pause now. I want to talk about playoff crowds. And it is easy to go to a playoff game and be like, that's a loud crowd. Check out how loud the crowd. Most playoff games are a loud crowd. And the reason that we think it this way is because most baseball games are not loud crowd. And that is because the experience of going to a baseball game during the regular season is... it's a different sport. It's a different thing to do. You are watching every pitch in October. Everyone is cheering. It's great. It's the best. And so when certain crowds are particularly loud and rise beyond the expected atmosphere that we have, I think it is worth noting. And what we have seen in San Diego over the past 2 days was legitimately special. Just the energy of that place seemed infectious and raucous. And did you have FOMO, Mr. No FOMO?
Well, I would just say that this has been a crowd that has separated itself in the regular season. This is one of the rare atmospheres that in the big games that we've seen them have, this year, it has felt, you know, October-esque. So once we finally got here, and I think that, again, once again on paper, everything was leaning San Diego. And as soon as Tatis hits the ball to the moon as the second batter of the game, it was, I mean, we talked about earlier, it's like, oh, the relief for Baltimore. It wasn't relief. There was no concern. It was just like, yeah, of course, this is what we're going to do here.
Now we go.
Which was awesome. It was incredible.
Let's chat about Fernando, because in our minds, he was on the 2022 San Diego Padres team. He was not. The run that they made when they beat the Dodgers, first the Mets, then the Dodgers, and then played the Phillies in the CS, Fernando was on, he was in the naughty corner, as they used to say on, I think, Super Nanny. You know, he did the peds.
He was.
80 game, no,
you
no.
You sit over there and think about what you've done.
And I have to say, Fernando, to his credit, appears to have sat over there and thought quite a bit about what he has done. All indications are that this is something of a matured individual. And to see him have that moment, his first playoff game, his first playoff at bat in front of fans, because he played in the 2020 playoffs and was amazing in those.
Yeah, I guess he had, right, it was an empty Petco Park in the earlier rounds. I guess he had some fans in Texas, but still very different.
Wow. Wow, I mean, wow.
Is, and I've been saying this since he came back, that just like him, for how long they had missed him in this regular season, this is a massive deal for him to be on this team again. And part of why it is looking like one of the best lineups in baseball and a team that can, you know, make a serious run. So while it was against AJ Smith-Shawver in a very tough situation and a Braves offense that obviously we've already talked about is, and as we'll learn over these next two games, just not very good. It has some very specific abilities, but it's not in the scenario that game went exactly as expected, with one very important other game one note.
Well, we need to introduce a character to our story.
Yeah.
And that character is the spiciest thing to ever come out of Rhode Island.
Yes. Yes.
We the smallest state in the nation seems to have produced the man with the biggest stones, and that is Michael freaking King. Crown him, Jordan Schusterman. We did not even say that he was going to start game one.
No, I
we
did. Were like, I did. I know I did.
Oh, you did.
I did. It's okay. I did mention because we had just gotten it right before recorded, but it was
like
not. In fact, I said it. That's the thing. I said it in the context of, oh, it's not Dylan Cease. Oh, Michael King.
But Jordan, it's such a badass move. Because now you have Cease game one against the Dodgers. Of course, that's part of the
calculus, right? And we'll talk about what happened to game two in a second.
Dude, he was so good.
This was
saucy and spicy, and like he had this aura about him where he was moving on the mound like he just knew he was going to strike everybody out. King, who was acquired in the Yankees deal for Juan Soto, trading away Juan Soto is never good. The San Diego Padres picked themselves a winner. King was dominant. The moment that will stick in my mind was the strikeout of Travis d'Arnaud late in this game, where King threw a slider that ended up in the first base dugout, and d'Arnaud swung at it and almost made me miss Javier Baez.
It was Baez-esque. Brent Rooker had a great thread about this exact swing, talking about why and how this happens to major league hitters. But to your point, I mean, King was just, it was, and when he's on, his stuff is outrageous. It's just, he's moving it in all kinds of different ways. But shame on us for not taking him more seriously in general. Now, not that any of us were expecting this kind of performance, but he's just been an outstanding starting pitcher now for a year and a half. And that was a big bet for the Padres to say, yes, this guy can impact our rotation for 30 starts. I said, yeah, maybe for 21. He did it for 30, man. He was awesome. And now here's another one. And wow. Am I excited to watch? I can't wait to watch him against the Dodgers. I'm so excited for that.
But he was not the only former Yankee to make his mark upon this game, as Kyle Higashioka, the home run Stroka.
I mean,
ripped a ding dong out to put the capper on San Diego's game one win. Higashioka, who was great for most of the season and then really bad in September. Jordan, if you go to the MLB YouTube channel, where I actually do spend a good bit of time because I watch a lot of game highlights on there. If you look at like the thumbnails, there is a thumbnail on their page that just says home run Stroka with a picture of Kyle. Higgy Homer, Kyle Higashioka has Petco Park rocking 42,000 views in one day.
Well, and just
people
remember,
love the home run
Stroka. Remember, like he's also just thrown into this trade after.
Because they want to play Austin Wells every day.
After what? 14 years in the Yankees organization, I think. Yeah. 12 or something. He was drafted out of high school in 2008. Okay. And it's just always been a Yankee, always been the Yankees backup. And to go to San Diego and hit 17 home runs and now a few more in the playoffs is just one of the wilder parts of this Padres season, easily. Because the catching position has been a problem for the Padres for a while. And while he's still, you know, still not one of the best catchers left, the fact that he's given them anything is just amazing. So Higashioka homers. And I mean, this was just the easiest, one of the easier postseason wins I've seen in a while. But we were kind of baking that in. We kind of thought this was exactly what was going to happen in game one, and it did. So we go into game two with Max Fried against Joe Musgrove, thinking, okay, that's how it looked. That's what we expected. But Max Fried is better than Joe Musgrove. And this is still a short series, and maybe the Braves will not roll over. And they didn't. This game was a little bit tighter, but for briefly, we thought it was going to be another runaway train. Braves score early. Michael Harris, an outstanding couple of games. He looked fantastic, really, for them down the stretch. So they score early. But then in the second, even though Max Fried gets the first two outs, after getting the first two outs, the Padres hit for the cycle, starting with another home run Stroka home run. Another home run that was Stroka'd by Higashioka. Higashioka homer, Arise single, Tatis single, Profar single, Machado double, Merrill triple. And it's 5-1 Padres. And now it's like game over. I was like, all right, that's a wrap. Let's just move this along so we can record this podcast tonight. And instead, the Braves slowly come back. So Soler hits a ball to center field that I believe as we record this at 12:30 in the morning, we still do not have a Statcast estimate on because it was hit so far. And to center field. This happens every once in a while where the Statcast reading just doesn't register. Is it a coincidence? Possibly. But I'm going to tell myself that he hit it so hard and so far that Statcast was like, whoa, what happened? Because that's more fun. So that, you know, gives the Braves a little bit more life. And then Michael Harris, again, with the home run off Jason Adam, makes it a one-run game. And now, as we kind of preview coming into the series, Robert Suarez is going to have to close this down after being a little bit shaky down the stretch. Soler lines out. Merrill. Merrill, come on. What's the first thing you learn when you play outfield?
First step is always back.
And on a 109-mile-an-hour line drive, he steps in and he's like, oops. Bolts back, makes the play. That's one out. Laureano grounds out. Darno pops out. And the Padres are moving on. Only other important note from this game is that Joe Musgrove left early with reported elbow soreness. How this will impact the Padres' pitching plans in the DS, we will talk about that tomorrow. But probably not good news. And if you're Martin Perez, Martin Perez just became possibly very important. So
stay by the phone, Martin.
We will circle back to him when necessary. Let's push the Padres to the DS, where they will play the Dodgers, and it will be very fun. But again, let's talk about that tomorrow. Let's say goodbye to the Braves, and then let's take a break, and then let's talk about the Brewers and the Mets.
The Atlanta Braves season is unfortunately simple and boring. Their two best players, Ronald Acuña Jr. and Spencer Strider both suffered two season-ending injuries. Austin Riley got hurt early, missed some time, was not really the same, missed a big chunk at the end of the year, was out for the playoffs. Ozzie Albies missed a big chunk of time. Sean Murphy missed a big chunk of time and then was just clearly not okay for most of the year. He was horrible. Injuries really screwed this team. However, the offense was not good by the end. Really not good. And again, some of that is you're hitting Ramon Laureano and Giovanni Urshela and like, yeah.
Like, yeah. Some of it is Matt Olson being bad for a long time, is Sean Murphy being not a good hitter at all, right? Arcia, who was a good hitter last year, was horrific this season.
Particularly with runners in scoring position. I believe he had like the lowest OPS plus.
Besides Ozuna, everyone else took a step backwards.
It is building your whole offseason around Jared Kelnick, who by the end of this was unplayable. From the pitching side of things, incredible. Schwellenbach. Oh my God. What a horrifying thing he's going to be for people.
Sure.
Chris Sale. I know it ended weirdly, but a season for the ages. Mm-hmm. Really. An all-time comeback story. He will win the Cy Young.
His first Cy Young, right? I mean, what an amazing thing that's what is likely what that is headed for.
Hey, did you vote? We never talked about. I guess you did vote.
I did vote, but I can't talk about that. It was not. I can't talk about that on here. But I will talk about it at some point soon.
I forgot to ask you about that. Yeah. Sorry.
We'll circle back on that. But yeah, I mean, kind of like with Houston, there was too much that went wrong that put them in position to be in this wild card round, right? They were still a good enough team. They still had enough good players to get into the postseason, and credit to them for that. And like Houston, there is still a lot of reasons to be very optimistic for next season. Most notably, hopefully you got Ronald Acuna and Spencer Strider back. That would be pretty freaking cool. So, but you mentioned Schwellenbach, right? Michael Harris, I think there's still a lot of reasons to be super excited about his future. So there are definitely some questions about this Braves team. But there was a lot of that happened this year where it was just probably not meant to be. And so this being the conclusion is not especially stunning. So that's it. That's the Braves. Bye, Braves. Bye. Bye, Braves. See ya.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we will talk about Mets Brewers first two games. Why is Willy Adames yelling at Jesse Winker? Why is Jesse Winker yelling back? And we'll preview game three. And welcome back to Baseball Barbercast. I want to make one last point about the Padres. I want to bring up a former Padre who caught my attention today with a tweet. A gentleman who played in 82 games for the Padres during his career. Jorge Alfaro, who had an iconic moment where he said, "Let's bleep and go San Diego," a bunch of times while cursing. Jorge Alfaro, who had not tweeted since March 27th, 2023, tweeted LFGSD tonight upon the Padres' victory. Alfaro, who I assume is playing in Mexico still and like hitting pretty well and will play in the Dominican Winter League forever.
Shockingly, apparently not playing in Mexico, at least not yet, but he will almost certainly be back, as you mentioned, in Lidom. But it doesn't look like he's played anywhere this year. So
anyway, I love that, right? Like, guy barely played there, doesn't tweet, was watching this game and was like, I'm gonna fire this out. 79,000 people have seen it so far. Love that. That's, love the internet. All right.
That's great.
Enough about Colombian backup catchers. Let's do Mets Braves. So the Mets and the Braves split the first two games. We're going to kind of turbo mode the beginning
Mets
of this.
Brewers. It's okay. We're late. It's late.
Mets Braves.
Mets Braves is over.
Both teams.
Very over.
Both teams were trying to win these two baseball games.
Mets Brewers.
Mets Brewers. Thank you. I met the Milwaukee Braves. The Milwaukee.
Okay. That's a very different series. So we'll go a little bit quicker on this one. I mean, listen, we got a third game coming up. So we don't have as big picture takeaways about these two teams. But again, Mets roll in game one, and you may be worried that they're going to have some of the same issues as the Braves, except they were feeling way better after Monday than Atlanta was. And so the fact that they went in there in game one, and even though Luis Severino didn't look awesome, The Mets responded very quickly. The Brewers take out Freddy Peralta very quickly.
Too
68
quickly.
Pitches through four. And then it just, I mean, again, Brewers bullpen has been very good, but the Joel Piamps experience, at least in game one, was a bad one as him and Aaron Ashby and Nick Mears just implode together for a 5-run fifth inning to the point where that's, I mean, the Brewers just didn't recover. I mean, talk about sucking the air out of the stadium there. The Mets just felt like, how can we possibly stop this team? And Severino ends up grinding through six innings, which was incredibly important when you consider the state of the Mets bullpen. And they had a large enough lead where they were able to hang on to things. Jesse Winker and Willy Adames were yelling at each other. At some point, Winker had hit a game-tying triple early in the game and just seemed to be yelling at Adames while he was rounding the bases on a triple, which is kind of unique.
Okay, so Winker is a one-of-a-kind character and clearly an oddball who, if he's going well and is on your team and you're winning games, is great. And if you're not doing either of those things, is maybe grades on people a little bit.
Yeah.
And I like him.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't speak to exactly what his reputation was when he hit 199 for the Brewers in 61 games last year, but
yeah,
maybe it wasn't great. But either way, he was yelling at Adames. Adames was yelling back. Nothing really came of it other than you could see Adames seemingly mouthing, we'll settle it in the parking lot.
Which I know that's like, let's fight in the parking lot. But in my mind, I'm thinking about Fast and Furious before the series got too big.
Yeah.
When it was really just all about let's race in the parking lot.
That's true. Humble beginnings for that series. Yeah. But anyway, then the Mets were just like, all right, you can't stop us.
Pour it on.
And for the Brewers, after what happened last year, it was like,
yeah,
God damn, like, this is a tough look. You know, Savali ends up just kind of throwing a bunch of mop-up work and Buto and Stanek close it out. And now we're just thinking, okay, Brewers, really? This is how you're going to go out? Like, you have this amazing season. You have this top three run differential. And no. Because Jack Cicurio had other plans in game two, Jake Mintz. As the Mets score early, but Jack Cicurio, the 20-year-old, this dude was born in 2004. But you wouldn't know it if you watched him play baseball. As he immediately responded with a game-tying homer in the bottom of the first. The Mets go up again in the second. Montas, not great. The Brewers make it a one-run game after five. Here comes Trevor Megill. He's throwing 101 miles an hour. He looks great. Piamps comes back in. He loads the bases. Now we think the Mets are going to blow it open again. He walks Lindor intentionally to load the bases with second and third. And he strikes out Condoleezza himself to get out of the inning. He's hyped up. Seventh inning, very important moment here as Gary Sanchez gets a single and Garrett Mitchell pinch runs for him and immediately gets caught stealing. That's one of the worst sequences you can have, let alone in a postseason game, right? The pinch run, caught stealing, wombo combo is just the worst. We hate that.
It's the Colton Wong Memorial 2013 World Series.
There have been a few over the years, but the pinch running toot plan is just, it's just
the Miles Straw one this
Miles
year
Straw
was all-timer
earlier, right? Paying attention to Guardians regular season baseball at the end of the year there. Anyway, so then it's like, oh God, Garrett Mitchell, what are you doing? Top of the eighth. Now, at this point, Reed Garrett and Ryan Stanek have already thrown, and the top of the order is up. This is a tie game at this point. The Mets are up by three, or up by one. It's 3-2. And it's like, okay, we got a one run lead, and we got six outs to get. It's the top of the order. Cheerio's coming up. Do we go to Edwin Diaz here? Edwin Diaz, who threw a billion pitches to help the Mets get into the postseason.
Diaz, who's like, his arm is like hanging by a thread, and he's like, I'm fine. It's right. Just a flesh wound.
Obviously did not pitch on Tuesday. They didn't need him and he wasn't going to anyway. But it was like, is he available today? Like, we just assumed yes, because we're all stupid fans. But they go with Phil Baton, who has pitched in these spots a lot this season. Jack Cicurio was like, fantastic. I love that you're putting in Phil Baton because I can hit another even farther opposite field home run. And that ties the game immediately to lead off the eighth. And a couple batters later, Garrett Mitchell is up again. Now he's batting the pinch runner with the chance for redemption. And he does it because that's what October's all about. He blasts one to right center, gives the Brewers the lead. It's 5-3. Maton, two home runs. Anytime a reliever gives up two home runs, it's a pretty brutal feeling. Mostly because anytime a reliever gives up one home run, it's pretty devastating. So giving up two, including the lead in a postseason game when you have a chance to advance, is very, very unfortunate. Devin Williams comes in and does Devin Williams things, and the Brewers force a game three.
Can you keep talking? I'm going to look up playoff instances of relievers allowing two home runs in a game.
Yeah, how many of them are as poorly timed as this? I of course it's happened, but that sequence, you know, you were a reliever. It's a tough moment.
I never gave up two homers in a game, though. So
I'm
going to
say
that
is, damn, that's a good point.
Hell yeah.
You were just so good. That 1 year. Yeah, exactly. You didn't face enough batters. I want to say one thing about Garrett Mitchell, and then we'll pivot to game three.
Go ahead.
I just think that he is an underrated, not necessarily character, but just like player for this team. I mean, this is a first round pick in 2020, who was, his injury at the start of the season in spring training was a big part of why it was like, man, just this Brewers season might be kind of tough. You know, one of the few things we were excited about, now Garrett Mitchell goes down. But once he came back, he was great. I mean, he was an above average hitter playing a lot of really good defense in center field. Like, this is a really, really good, important player for them to build around. And especially in with Yelich's absence, like, he's just been so important for them, particularly as a left-handed hitter, which they don't have a lot of very good ones right now. So I just thought the sequence was pretty interesting, but I just think Garrett Mitchell, as we move forward, maybe they get eliminated on Thursday, none of this matters, but he is a very interesting player for me. But yeah, they force game three. I don't know if your stat heading succeeded, if you had any notable ones, but any thoughts about game three? I believe we'll be seeing Tobias Myers against Jose Quintana.
The most recent one before today was AJ Smith Shawver, who allowed three home runs in relief last year,
right,
in game four of the, I believe it was game four of the NLDS against the Phillies.
Right. And that's the thing about Shawver, is like, he's got great
game
stuff,
three.
But it's just too many
game
fly
three.
Balls.
This was the Bryce staring at Arcia game. So Smith Shawver apparently allowed three home runs in that game in relief. No recollection of that happening. And I was obviously there. But this happens. Clark Schmidt did this in an ALCS game.
Okay.
It's pretty great.
Oh, like, was that against Cleveland?
Against Houston.
Yeah, but again, like, this felt pretty tough.
Clayton the one is Kershaw against the Nats in 2019.
Yep.
That's the one, dude.
Yep.
Oh, back to back.
Oh, how could we forget? Anyway, but the point is, like, is that we find out after that Diaz was probably not available for more than an inning. And so could they have used him there? Sure. Did they want him to maybe face 3-4-5 or 4-5-6? Sure. Like, I don't want to crush Mendoza too much for it, but obviously it's more like, maybe you just hope you have better relievers than Phil Maton. And Phil Maton's been fine this year, but that's kind of where that comes down to. And Jackson Chourio is amazing. He deserves more attention and more time on this podcast. But for now, we will spin it to game three.
Dansby Swanson, Jorge Soler off Christian Javier in game four of the 2021 World Series.
Javier,
left
another
line, the
another
ball that,
he can give him up.
The ball that Yordan almost caught. All right.
Game three. Tobias Myers, Jose Quintana. Sorry, can I just say that sentence again? Let's just rewind to the start of the season. Let's just go back to March. All right, Jake. Game three, elimination game, wildcard series, Mets Brewers, Jose Quintana against Tobias Myers.
Do you know what sounds impossible, but it's
Jose
true?
Jose Quintana was the opening day starter.
I understand. You know what sounds impossible? Jose Quintana never played for the Brewers. Feels like he must have at some point.
That's wrong.
He never played for the Brewers.
No, he was definitely.
Right?
On. He wasn't?
Nope.
There's still time. He smells like a Brewer next year.
Oh, yeah. I mean, 1 year, $7 million. Thanks for coming.
He will be, I guess Tobias Myers will still be there, but him and Tobias Myers will be teammates next year. I don't know. This is a weird matchup. I guess, like, I don't know how homer prone Tobias Myers is. He isn't exactly like striking out the world, but he's been so consistent. I mean, the issue here is that the Brewers bullpen, like some of these middle inning guys have just not been, I guess McGill was pretty good, but Myers is, I mean, it's not a great ground ball rate, but he hasn't allowed too many home runs. So I don't know. It kind of smells like we're just going to see like 4 or 5 home runs in this game 3, which could be fun because we haven't actually seen that many homers so far through these first couple days.
The Brewers tend to actually be worse against left-handed pitching than right-handed pitching, even though they don't have a whole lot of left-handed bats. Weird. If you just go by season-long WRC+, I mean, that's kind of a lazy way to do it. But maybe I'll dig in a little bit more there and send a tweet out. Yeah, I'm excited to see a game 3 in Milwaukee. It just feels like they just have been getting swept for the last 10 years, and like seeing them crawl past this round would be very encouraging.
Yeah, and right. I mean, not that Brewers Phillies would not be compelling, but the prospect of Mets Phillies is pretty juicy. So we will see.
Jordan. Mm-hmm. As an unbiased individual who would love to go to games 3 and 4 of a playoff series and sleep in his own bed, the Mets winning would not not be anti that. However, Milwaukee, most underrated city
like
in America.
Milwaukee, so
most underrated city in America.
They still have
a
World Series run in them. I still haven't been there. That's one of the few parks I still have left to check off. So I would love for them to keep this run going and get me to Milwaukee at some point over the next few weeks. That's it.
There's 1,000 other things going on,
of course,
again, because teams are announcing news now. This bugs me. Teams, like things that are useful and interesting, teams are always being like, this person will be very important for our front office next year and is someone that you should now know about, but you won't remember this because you're watching 4 playoff games today.
Yeah. And man, I have so many Buster Posey thoughts, but they're going to have to wait for November. So thank you all for listening. Thank you to Andrew Hartz for staying up way late to produce this podcast. Hopefully you all enjoyed us staying up late to get you these recaps. We will be back late tomorrow after that game 3 between the Mets and the Brewers to recap that and preview the division series, which we are very, very, very excited to cover. But until then, you can email us, baseballbarbcast@gmail.com, BARBcast. Thank you, Producer Hartz. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you all very soon.